Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health.
Last episode, we talked about what happens when a school starts to see the child as a problem. Often by that point, there is already a plan in place. The adjustments are documented, but yet the behaviour sometimes can escalate. Today is about a very uncomfortable possibility that sometimes a plan exists, but the plan is not appropriate or not being applied. When I did a survey on Instagram as to what listeners wanted to hear on the Thursday, it was overwhelmingly over 80% that mums wanted to hear how practically to apply the skills and strategies from the Tuesday's episode. And I immediately was overwhelmed and had no idea what the fuck to do. So I have been Sally and Kat. Welcome to you, Sally and Kat.
Thanks, Jane.
Okay. Awesome. Sal is a pediatric OT and Kat is a pediatric speechy, and they've both worked inside, outside the system. They have kids that are neurodivergent. Sal and Kat both have got lived experience of being in the neurodivergent space with people that they know or in their family, and know what it's like to be a mum advocating hard for their children. So they've been on both sides of it, which is perfect for this podcast. When I reached out to Sally on a Friday afternoon and said, please, could you come over in the next week? She was actually meeting up with Kat, and I have hijacked their meeting and convinced them both to come in and do the practical elements to the podcast. So, Sally, one of the things that we covered last episode, which was really tricky and I didn't know the answer to, was when a plan is technically in place, but a child is still escalating in their behavior, what does that mean about the plan or the child? Sometimes schools will jump to that it isn't the right setting for the child, but Ren on Tuesday talked about maybe the plan isn't the right fit for the child. What do you think about that?
And I think the idea of a plan is that it's something that we continually come back to. It's the start of a conversation and that we can revise. We're not always going to get it right. So we're going to do the best we can with the information we have at the time to make an informed decision about what we think might work. But we want to just be starting small with a few things in place that's manageable for both the education team and also the child. Sometimes what I personally have seen is that we put all of these strategies in place and we're trying to do it all at the one time. And then we're saying, oh, the plan's not working. Like, we know that if you've ever tried to do anything in your life, you have all the strategies and you're trying to do them all at once. And we wonder why they don't work. Same sort of thing. So we want the opportunity to have multiple check-ins and have a collaborative conversation, not just a set and forget plan.
Yeah, I was also just thinking then, I liked when you're saying it, that it's, you need to go back to it. It's like that sometimes I think these individualized learning plans, or whatever they are called, different spots, they are seen as a manual for the child. And it's like, we had one meeting, we decided, and this is what we will do, and then this is what will happen. When really, I mean, that's just the start of the conversation. So it's a hypothesis. So these are things that adults are making a really often informed but educated guess about what is causing the behavior and what will help improve this behavior or help this child's experience at school. But unless it's tried and tested and reviewed, then we just have, it has to be seen as that starting point. And I think when you were saying about that, sometimes these plans are used as a documentation to say, look, this has all been done and it's still not working for your child. I think we have to ask a bit more about the plan itself. So does everybody know what's on that plan? Is everybody actually comfortable with the strategies, or has it been something that potentially has the teacher really has to take on for 15 students, but it's not really practical? I just think, yeah, let's look at the plan a little bit more and how it's implemented.
And bigger than that, who is supporting the teacher to implement the plan? Is there enough support to make that actually doable and accessible?
Okay, I love that. Follow-up question, of course. When you were talking about, is it possible with that personalised learning plan or the IEP or whatever you got in your state, in your experience, do you think sometimes the adjustments come in but they're not actually able to be done by the classroom teacher? Do you think they sit through the meeting and actually think, I don't know if I can do that? That's the first question. Second question is, with the PLP or the IEP, do you get more than one go at it? Because both of you mentioned ongoing consultation, and this is just a start, and then you get to have a conversation. what I'm hearing from listeners is they are fighting to get anyone to give them 15 minutes of a plan to start with. So when we're talking about ongoing consultation, is that something, or do you get one shot at it and that's all you get? Because I think maybe the schools are saying to the parent, you're lucky to get even one meeting, but then the ongoing consultation is what you're talking about.
I feel like if it's a once and done, and that's why the whole concept of plan B, plan C exists. And so I do think that families should have that right to ask for feedback and explicit information as to why hasn't it been working. And in practice, because if the strategies are right, if they're able to be employed consistently by the teacher, we should see some positive outcomes. That's why it was created. So I do think that there is a place for parents to be saying, okay, so you said we were going to do this for 6 weeks and see a particular outcome. What are we seeing? Can I have some examples that speak directly to that plan?
Yeah, and you're right. That's absolutely all right. Like, we have the Disability Inclusion Act as something that governs all of the work in which we do. And these plans are there to be able to make the accommodations for children to ensure they can be successful in this environment. Like, every single child has the right to an education, and it is our role, all of our roles, is coming together as partners collaboratively to make that possible, right? And so there is the opportunity for you to come back and revisit and have those conversations about strategies.
There's one word that just irks me, and I just want to pull it out now, and it's the word accommodation, because it implies above, beyond, different, when actually I prefer the word a consideration, something that could be considered.
Did I just say accommodation?
Well, it's widely used.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
they're
saying. That's right. It's all about, right to reasonable accommodation. I mean, it's through the NDIS, it's through the education system. But I also think that that could potentially also trigger for teachers this is extra for your load, when it doesn't always have to be. Consideration of how a child might get the best out of their learning could be as powerful, but doesn't have that stigma attached.
Awesome point, because I think when we're thinking about schools and education systems who do this really well, there's this universal base of inclusion before we're considering any specific needs coming into the room. We have a universal base of how can any child access this space comfortably. And when we're thinking about a universal base of inclusion, we should have flexible seats. We should have visuals available. We should have multiple ways to be able to communicate, to be able to express ourselves through different writing tools, different seating options, all of the things. They should just actually be a part of our learning environments. And then when we go to think about considerations.
Yes.
When we think about considerations, like if I was thinking about my own son, for example, oh, we know Henry's coming in and he is hypermobile. He fatigues really, really quickly. We know that this particular seating option is really helpful for him. So we'll, you know, ensure he knows that's available for him. Or when he's starting to fatigue, we know we will prompt him to be able to do, you know, something different that isn't so taxing on his physical ability. But I think coming back to Jane's initial question about in the room when we're having these meetings and we have the head of inclusion, you know, leading that meeting often, and we have everyone around the table. And I've been in this conversation both professionally and personally, and from an advocacy perspective of children that I've worked with, and then also myself. And you're absolutely right in saying that you have the most experienced person in the room telling us what's possible, right? And they've had the PD, they've had years of experience. That's why they are in the roles that they are. And then you have sometimes a guidance counselor, sometimes you have other supporting teachers, and you have then the classroom teacher. Now, that classroom teacher who's going to implement it has varying abilities, right? So varying experiences. They may be a new graduate. They may have had years and years of experience where they've implemented strategies that were unsuccessful, right? Or whatever it might be. And so yeah, we're putting these plans into place, but it's a very intimidating and hard platform for that teacher to say, I don't know how to do that, or I don't think I can do that, or who do I ask for help there?
We talk a lot about, we have this need for the individualized planning in a group of 28 children. And I often just wonder whether there is the opportunity to look at all of the IEPs that are in a room and actually see if there are commonalities across them. Because I feel like that would help translate what our children are needing into that cohort. So what you're looking at is, yes, they've got all these individual needs, but hold on a minute, we're seeing some themes with this group. And so, yeah, what if we could then look at those 26 children, look at the commonalities in terms of their strengths, their areas of weakness, and actually look at what are those considerations or those accommodations look like for that entire class. And if there are, that goes back to that universal, if there are similarities, then whoop, let's implement that across the class. But it is based within the child's individual learning plan. I think that could be a way of just helping it come to life a little bit more. And I know that, yeah, if you only get that one shot in the meeting, and that's often when you do have to sign off on the PLPs to be able to request verbally and have that written on the document that you're signing, that there's an agreement that this will be reviewed at 3 months, 6 months, I think jump onto that if that's that opportunity to all be in the room together, to have it written down and signed off, I think just gives that extra accountability layer.
If we can strip it back, go back to the interview that we had with Ren on Tuesday. So we're looking at a child who is possibly escalating, their behaviours are maybe disrupting the classroom, and the school is looking at them like, do we want to keep this child? That's awful to say, but that's realistically what they're probably doing. I was wondering, particularly with you, Kat, being a speechy, how often do you think behaviour plans are written without really considering language processing or expressive capacity? And I thought you might have some great perspective on that as well, Sal.
Look, I think I have seen that if a very clear communication delay disorder is their primary disability. So if we know a child has childhood apraxia of speech or is minimally speaking, then that's going to be front of mind. But I have found that outside of that cohort of children, every other child, I'll say every child that actually requires a behaviour support plan is going to have fluctuating abilities in their processing and their ability to express themselves. And that's just a given. And I do notice that if that is included in the plan, it is not explicit. It is quite generic. And it also tends to rely on saying, okay, this is where the child has trouble. Here are the external ideas or things that you could do to support. But it's really non-specific, and it's not giving the teachers very clear saying, okay, these might be some times that the child is triggered. And here, if you adjust your language in X, Y, Z, it will keep the child calm. There's ways that I think, particularly when we're looking at supporting behaviour, that it can often be caused by a breakdown in the language processing of, did they not understand what was being said to them? Did they misinterpret it? Just thinking of some of our little kids who are really communicative and can express themselves, but are literal thinkers. That might be worth putting into a plan, because that could cause anxiety. So I know a little person I'm thinking about who had a really tricky shutdown at school because he was told, once we finish this, we can go out and you can have your lunch. But he froze because he automatically thought that finish meant the entire 2 pages that they'd started before he could go to lunch. And so he didn't know that if that was finish this sentence, finish this page, finish this word, and then he knew that he couldn't possibly finish the whole. And then that then looks like refusal. Yeah, so you can see that there are subtle ways that language just really needs to be considered.
And that's what we're sort of talking about, and what we will continue to talk about this whole episode. It's like these small nuances, right, that, you know, you would look at that and think, well, that was a really well-meaning teacher and a very simple instruction. Why did that break down? Why was that so hard? I don't understand. That's the specific information that can be just so helpful.
And you can see why when we see these recommendations in learning plans of benefits from repeating the question, benefits from having it chunked into smaller pieces. What does that mean? That's really tricky to actually, what type of language is hard? Is it the academic language that's hard? Is it when we start to combine mathematics with spoken language problems? We really need to be a lot more specific in how teachers can adjust their language, and also at what level and at what times can the high language load cause, a lot of these challenges.
And from a parent's perspective of, if you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, well, that all sounds great, but what do I actually do? And I think that's why they're meant to be round table conversations with the speech pathologist, with the occupational therapist, with the therapist in your life. And if you don't have your own individual therapist, the school has access to therapists to pull in into those conversations. And they're things you can request and ask for to give those really specific, nuanced strategies, right?
What is really sticking out to me listening to you ladies talk is when you're talking about the nuances, particularly within speech and communication. So when you were talking about the small adjustments and how one child can shut down over that particular sentence, that's something that I wouldn't have considered. And I think I'm quite educated in the area. So I'm trying to imagine if I'm the classroom teacher and I've probably, I don't know, maybe had 3 coffees all day and barely any food, and I'm coming into the meeting running late, probably, you know, like when I've seen classroom teachers come in, you can see they're on the pump. They sit down, it's like, you know, you kind of want to give them a coffee, like, are you all right? And I was putting myself in their position. If you have an inclusion head that's coming in, they've got the expertise. You've got some really tricky communication and speech that maybe the classroom teacher's not super well versed in. Even as the mother, it can be really hard to understand what is the difference between this and that, particularly if we're talking about tricky things like PDA. PDA I find very tricky. So then from a parent's perspective, with what we can actually do today, we can't change the system. But maybe it's worth, as a parent, checking in with the classroom teacher, giving them a moment to go, hey, do you think you could actually accommodate? Sorry to use the accommodate word.
No, I accommodate in that way.
I actually think the way that you've mentioned consideration and accommodation is fucking awesome, because it does feel, from a parent perspective, that it's a fucking favor, which is why I got so angry in the Wren episode where they were talking about the dollar figures. And I felt like it was me begging for a favor for them to give my child an extra 5 fucking minutes, right? And so when we talk about accommodations, I think you're on the money there, because it's not an accommodation. It's a consideration for how that child feels for a fucking moment.
Yep.
That shouldn't be that hard if the teachers weren't so stressed and didn't have so many kids, right? It wouldn't be that hard. I'm sure they would do it. So anyway, going back to the meeting, from a mother's perspective, do you think it's worth saying to the teacher, do you understand some of the things that we're talking about? Do you think you could actually implement them in your classroom? If you can't, that's okay. What do you think you could do? Because I'm concerned that you have this high-level meeting with these people that know what they're talking about. That's great. But then it's like when you go home, you're all excited, and then your child comes home and goes, they still put the timers on in maths or whatever it is that you spoke about. And then you feel like you're going fucking insane.
Yeah.
Maybe the gap is that the classroom teachers can't do it. And I wouldn't put my hand up and say, hey, I can't do that in my classroom either in that big meeting. Why would you do that?
I'm going to put my hand up as a speech pathologist. I think we have a part to play in that I feel like there has been reports that I've written. And when you, and particularly,
you're outing yourself.
Yep. I will out myself every day of the week. But particularly when I was in a role, which was purely consultative, it was an assessment. This was in the NT many years ago. And then it would be pretty much, here's a report, here's a bunch of worksheets. And it was almost like a tick and flick of recommendations. And I just don't think that's good enough anymore. And I will out my 10 year ago self, because we can actually break down those really complex reports in saying, what do they mean? Parents are paying the money and everyone's going through the process of being assessed. Then I do think we should be able to say, this is how this will affect class. This is how it will impact learning. And these are some ways to consider, some things to think about, which may help support them.
I think you are bang on the money. One of my friends, her daughter is in grade 3, and she's hitting some struggles around just school, right? I suppose behavior is being interpreted as defiant. One thing that she's up against is she's a single mom. She's doing the fucking best she can. And she rang me the other day and said, maybe we need to get a cognitive assessment. Maybe this is more than ADHD. And she's going to have to do a massive sacrifice to pay that $2,000 or $3,000 for that cognitive assessment. She rang me and I had goosebumps because I'm like, that's probably her holiday for the next 2 year period.
Yeah.
This is going to massively impact her life. And I said to her, you've got to let me think about it, because if you pay that money, you are running the risk that that school will read nothing of it, that the psychologist who's doing a great job, I'm sure be very comprehensive, is not going to give you a dot points of what they can actually do. And this $3,000 or $2,000 is going to be just off into the abyss. And then in 6 months' time, her child will develop in a different way, whatever it is, and then it will be obsolete as to what they're looking at right now, and it will go nowhere. And I said to her, you need to get the psychologist to actually talk to the school or break it down into what can actually work today. And she's looking at that the school are not willing to meet with a psychologist. A psychologist is not willing to break it down. And I said to her, I don't even think you should spend the money at this point. And this is me who believes heavily in cognitive assessments.
That story just actually makes my skin crawl, to be honest, of how ridiculous and how hard that is. It shouldn't be like, it actually shouldn't be like that. Schools have access to educational psychologists who can complete those assessments. And so there are schools here, like we're based on the Sunshine Coast, but there are some great schools here who those school psychologists working together to create the great outcomes for the children.
But assessment without a plan, an assessment without a real life translation, is, as I said, it's a process that is draining for all involved, financially, emotionally. And so, yeah, I think there's, and look, maybe that's something that we can, that I know more and more people are, families are going, I'm taking my report through AI because AI is able to tell me in plain language and help me translate it better than my allied health professional was. And I'm like, that's not good enough. But if there is a way, then we should use that.
Every state is different.
Yeah.
But in all of the emails, the DMs, the listener questions that I get through, and it'd have to be hundreds a week. I think we've got over 800 people have filled in jot forms on their school's experience. And I have never, ever seen one that has ever said to me the school has offered any educational psych, any extra at all. And my friend is paying a lot of money. I think it's about $6,000 or $7,000 a year, which is huge for primary school, and she's not seeing anything at all, at all. So I suppose my question is, Sal, when you're talking about they have access to these things, if no one's offering it, how do we know what we have access to and how do we request it?
Yeah, this is confusing. Like, this does get confusing, and I have had this experience professionally when working with families and working with the schools as well, like whether I have been in the school working as an occupational therapist, like in the school system, knowing what is available, and then the break, like it's a breakdown. That's what I think it is, like between the families and the school. If I'm thinking about how do I advocate best for my child? How do I understand what's available? How do I have these conversations? It's always going to start with assuming everyone's doing the best they can and coming in from a human to human experience with the school. If we're coming in somewhat demanding, or, you know, like with our defenses up, like the school like suddenly becomes really defensive as well, like really wary around that. There's so much that does happen from an operational perspective with schools, with allegations that are made against them, all this kind of stuff, right? Like it's pretty hard work, right? So from a parent's perspective, I think it's like when we're coming in, who is the right person? Like asking that question, like if I don't feel like my child is able to participate, I think we need further investigation. Who can I have this conversation with? How can I better understand what's available to them? And yet, what do I need to do to make that happen? Like in my experience, when you ask those questions, you receive those answers. So it's really, I guess that's just really upsetting to me to think that there's like over 800 responses that no one has said that these things are available or they feel supported from it. It's sort of, yeah.
I guess I'd say that your first point of call is always going to be the class teacher. And so, and I know you've spoke about it in different episodes as well. Sometimes you get off on the wrong foot with that teacher, or sometimes that teacher doesn't see what you see, and sometimes they do. And I think really trying to get on the same page and be in solidarity, and that if it's hard for you at home, it's going to be hard for her or him in the classroom. And it could be a slow relationship build of being on the same page is going to help open the communication as to who's the next step. And so then that might be the warm introduction to the inclusion professional or the guidance officer that's visiting at a certain time. I do think realistically they do have chains of communication that they need to go through as well. So being persistent, but also trying to see that as a team, we need to try to keep navigating this difficult system.
I think there is a place to, as a parent, to ask to speak with the principal of the junior school or the principal of the school, or like to better understand what's going on. If you're feeling like you are talking to the classroom teacher, and like we were just talking about how much they have on their plate, to go directly to, like, I know that's contradicting what you say, and that's why each school is so different.
Each school, each situation, each classroom is different.
Yeah, but, you know, like if you can build as well, like the communication pathways being a part of that school community, like I know at my school, the first thing I did from working in the system for so long is like, you know, what I'm going to do, I'm going to be a part of the PNC. I'm going to, you know, get involved from that perspective. I'm going to build relationship with my school principal. And what I want to do is just understand the system they're working within and understand their challenges. So then once I understand that, I can also do my best to advocate for my own children within that same system. And yeah, when you're like putting yourself out there and you are becoming a part of that school community where you can, and I do appreciate that's super, super challenging. And it's really, really challenging if, you know, you're a single parent and you have multiple children who have disabilities and all of the complexities to that. But, you know, it's like, how can I be a part of this community and to better understand what's going on and to get my voice heard through the right channel? How do I understand what that channel is? Well, sometimes that's from being involved in the school. Yeah.
Sally's the ultimate good person. So we're at the first public school together that I left. So I had a dust up and just fucking went out in flames and started thinking about how I could report them to the review board, how I could burn the school down because I was so fucking angry. And Sally goes in there, becomes the PNC president and like actually builds relationships. Whereas I was like, you know what? I'm going to fucking show down with that teacher.
This is like school survivor.
Yeah.
Where Sally played the social game and you went out for the physical challenges.
And you know what? I actually looked at Sally at the time and thought, I know that she has got a better strategy. I can see it. But my fucking rage won't let me.
I will take her to tribal council.
I was more like thinking, well, she's a good person and I'm obviously still learning and I'm just going to fucking go in there and get aggressive and get angry. However, leaving that school was a real sliding doors moment for me. And we lost a lot as a family from leaving. We really did. That makes me emotional talking about. Let's just put it in context. People love a practical example. My daughter had just gotten diagnosed and then I realized that where did it come from? And so I was in a real position of never having really known a lot about neurodiversity before, even though my brother's other has ADHD. Of course, I didn't. And, you know, I had a really... There's a big hidden cost, right, of being the internalizing child, which we'll get to another episode. So the classroom that my daughter was put in was a high needs classroom and it was managed by someone who was about to retire and someone that I believe had postnatal depression. She had two kids under two. I think the load on those two teachers was too high and they were not able to manage it. They had a lot of behaviors, a lot of kids running away, screaming. And then you've got, you know, your internalizers that have just been diagnosed or been diagnosed and then kind of been putting in the diagnosed classroom and then it was not managed very well. And I chose to leave because my husband said to me, because I was running my business and he said to me, we are losing like thousands of dollars in the weeks that you are consumed by fury and rage. We can't afford
to have you. Your rage has a cost.
Like, it does have a cost.
It does.
And aside from the fact I couldn't sleep, and the personal cost, we couldn't make money because I was consumed with the way that I felt my daughter was treated. And so we chose to leave. Fine. And there was another little girl, very similar to my daughter, who was also diagnosed at the same time with the same acronyms. They chose to leave her there and give it a go. The only thing that makes me sleep at night was that that child, who's still friends with my daughter, went through some pretty horrific school trauma and she was unable to leave the house for like over a year. She had 2 years, 2.5 out of schooling, and still now she struggles to pick up a pen and write because of the trauma that went on in that period that I removed my daughter from that classroom. And my friend chose to give it more of a go, which at the time I didn't think was a bad decision. I actually thought she's a better person than me in some way for giving it more of a go. So there's these moments of like, one, is it working or am I just throwing shit at a wall and nothing's happening, this isn't working? So I suppose my final question would be in this episode to both of you is, when we're reflecting on Ren's episode and we're reflecting on when a school comes out and says, hey, I don't think that this is the right setting for that child, Ren's response was, is it the child or is it the personalized learning plan? What is it about the plan that isn't working that's creating these behaviors that is disrupting the classroom, for example? And I was wondering from each of you, how do you know when it's worth persisting with building the relationship like you did, Sally, which I think is still the best route, don't get me wrong, or when is the right time to leave? And how can we look at the plan or the situation and make a decision about when should we leave? When should we stay and try and work closer with them? And what are some of the red flags or green flags that you should stay? Because when you're in a highly emotional state like I have been, you just don't even know what your gut is telling you because you're so upset or angry, for example.
It's a big one. And because it is so emotionally charged. And I also think that sometimes when families I've worked with have done all the research for this school, they were told all the right things when they came in. Their families thought that they had given all their information, so really laid bare the child's strengths, the things that they were having difficulty with, so that they didn't feel like the school could turn around and say, we can't support your family. But I had seen that then at times when that just turns into lip service, when you've been given that reassurance and then you're not seeing it happening, I do think you can only ask for accountability and inclusion so many times and be an equal partner and keep coming to the table and supporting the teachers and being respectful and all those things that are giving them the benefit of the doubt. But I think when you're not actually seeing whether it be the administration, the inclusion support people doing their bit, because if everyone's doing their bit, we should be seeing change and there should be the ability to go, okay, that didn't work. We need to try something different. It came up in the episode with Ren as well. It's also, if all you are getting is negativity and you are not getting some really true reflections of what makes your child so unique and special, to me, that says that curtain has gone down. They've put a child in that box of too hard, can't be supported.
I would say 100% agree with Kat and Jane, your reflection of me being the bigger person there. That was like, I was a prep mum coming in, seeing, you know, what was possible. And I think I came in to the PNC in the perfect storm. Like, our school principal had just gone on maternity leave for the first time. And it just seemed like everyone's hands were tied. There was no accountability to it at all. And I think had I been in your position with a child who was experiencing what your child was experiencing, I would 100% have done the same. And that, yeah, is something I consider all the time, because there are schools, there are good schools out there. Like, you would have got 800, you know, comments from families of things that are tricky, but like, maybe you could put on your stories, like, tell me the good things, tell me where your child was included, tell me the good things your school has done, because I have seen like thousands and thousands of examples of that. Without a doubt, there are really, really good people out there working in our schools, advocating really, really hard for our children. And so, yeah, we want to change the world. Yeah, we want to change the system. We know we can't. There does come a point, and exactly what Kat was saying, It's when we stop seeing the positivity for our children. But our children, yes, whilst they're incredibly resilient, they're so fragile. And yeah, I think about this with my son and his unique experience of the world and of education, and think, like, if we just put him in a different environment, would things be different? And how far do I go of working with his teacher and his team before I say, you know what, like, we're going to have to move on? And there does come a time. And I think that's when that document becomes a stagnant thing, where it's sort of like a yes or a no. That's when that's a complete red flag. It's meant to be a cycle. It's meant to be a conversation. It's meant to be something we check in regularly. Like you said, at the end of the meeting, we know when we're going to meet next. We know when the check-ins are. How do we actually know that this plan is working? What are the really specific goals and outcomes we will see to know this is working? And then what is my part to play as a parent? And what is your part to play as the professionals at the school? So, you know, how are we going to work together? How are we going to communicate? Are you going to email me? Are we going to meet? You know, getting that all in writing in that space. And yeah, and then being able to follow up. If your school is doing that and the team you're working with is doing that, you know that's the right place, even if your child's finding it a little bit tricky right now, because you know that that won't always be the case, right?
One more burning one, and then we will finish up. I did an episode with Vanessa Lapointe, and it was called something like Grieving the Child You Thought You'd Have and Loving the Child You Have, something like that. Yeah. I'll put in the episode in the show notes if anyone wants to listen. It was so interesting. And Vanessa talked about whether you have a daffodil or an orchid child. Do you guys know that one? You probably do, being in pediatrics. Yeah. So correct me if I explain this incorrectly. But basically, you could have an orchid child that is very environmental based, or they're a little bit more, I wouldn't say fragile, they're probably a little bit more susceptible to heat, to too much rain. That doesn't take much to kind of upset the equilibrium of that orchid. Where if you have a daisy, and basically it can grow into a little piece of pavement, it can grow in the dirt, you just, you know, shove a seed down there, it's okay. I would say that the daisy is a little bit easier, right, to say the least. I've got two orchids and one daisy. And my daisy child had a bit more of a tricky year last year. He had a lot of things going on, which I don't think the other two orchids would have coped with. And my daughter that I was talking about with Sally, she's more of an orchid. So she can't cope in environments that are difficult, don't work for her. She really goes downhill quite quickly. Whereas my son, who's the daisy, he just kind of can power through. I can support him at home. It's just 1 year. I know it's not great. You're going to be right, mate. We'll make sure it's better for you next year. And I was wondering, if is that a call you make as a mum or a parent? Like, I know this is a tricky year. I think my child can push through. I think we can make some things at home. I think it's okay. Versus maybe this child is an orchid and it's not going to work for them, and I need to call it because I'm worried it will be trauma. As a final question, what do you guys think about that? Or do you think it's not applicable?
I would say it's definitely applicable, because like you said, I mean, really clear there, some kids can handle and recover from setbacks quicker than others. And yet there might be other children who you're watching that each day something that seems little just seems to be compounding, and it gets bigger and it gets bigger. So what you're really seeing is, what is the impact on your child as to what's going on? And sometimes, small things. That dripping tap theory, it just fills them to capacity, and then they're actually not able to cope. It overflows. So I do think, as a mum, and I've got, similar combination of daisies and
dandelions, orchid and dandelion.
I do think there is a point to make around how your child is coping, because if they go, okay, there's a few setbacks, but they can see through the other side. They can internalize and go, okay, that was hard, but I got through it. That process of getting through it is character building and actually creates that sense of pride. And I had son who had that experience with going to camp, who I did not expect was going to struggle with camp, but found it very, it just came out of nowhere, very anxiety provoking. But we just took each next step. Let's just get you through till tomorrow if you want to call us. And if you really need to be picked up, we'll do that. But he knew he had an out, but then he was able to push himself through. And then next night he still called, but was able to get through. So his experience of actually getting through camp has really empowered him for the year.
Yeah, it's become resilience building.
But one of my other children,
traumatic.
My other children, when it's like, okay, this could be triggering quite a significant meltdown, in which case I will pluck him out of camp if he needs to be. So, different experiences and different abilities to cope.
How do you know the difference between, so when we're thinking about like our orchids and our dandelions, there's this great book that I would highly recommend. We can link it in the show notes to listen to. It's an audio book as well that sort of explains it. But it's about honouring your child's experience. When your child comes home and tells you about an experience and they're always referring to the really tricky things about it and how emotionally depleting that was, you can see it in their body, right? Like that wasn't a resilient building experience. That was something that was so hard that they need the time to recover from, whether they need to go like be more introverted and do that, or they need the support of people around them. But, you know, that is what they need versus dandelions who are like, oh, gee, that was hard and this is what I'm going to do tomorrow. Like they're able to self-talk. Book also talks about, and, you know, this theory talks about like how orchids may have had more early childhood sicknesses and, you know, just seem like more difficulty with just typical physiological things like sleep's a bit harder, eating's a bit harder, all the things are just a little bit more tricky versus, you know, our dandelions who, like we're talking about, they, in any condition, they're able to thrive type thing.
And I'll just finish on that one too. In terms of how do you know, I would also say you would notice some of the big feelings seeping into other areas of their life. So if when soccer was always an enjoyable experience where they could shake off the school day and still love the game of soccer, but instead they're exhausted, or then they're having some worries about soccer that they weren't having before, that you think, is this a flow-on effect from school? Also the way they are speaking about it. So if a child is coping, they'll be able to reflect and plan and able to even understand what happened, why it happened, with varying levels of ability given their ages. And then, what might happen if something similar happens? Like they're still able to access those parts themselves. If it's becoming too much, you're getting much more non-specific words. It's going to be harder to express what it is that's making them not want to go to school. It's going to get harder to really identify because all those tricky feelings are compounding and meshing together and flowing out across other areas of their life.
I love that. What a way to finish. If anyone would like to know more about the difference between trauma, I do have an episode with a psychologist, a name escapes me, but we did an episode on what's resilience, what's trauma, and how do you know the difference between both. If anyone would like to know more on that subject, you can always listen to that podcast episode as well. Thank you for the correction on the dandelion of the daisy. I really appreciate that. We'll put that into the show notes. Thank you so much. That was a brilliant episode. And I'm going to get Kat and Sal back next week to unpack the practical realities of integrating some of the tools from the Tuesday episodes to bring it down practically as to what we can do on the Thursday. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jane.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD Mums shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.